Many eyewitnesses report that planes dropped what I'll call incendiary devices on the community. So these would have been nitroglycerin or kerosene bombs that caused the flame to spread more rapidly and burn more brilliantly.
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty, and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists.
Estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor.
The promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home.
The other thing I want you to understand is this, that it didn't cost the nation one penny to integrate lunch counts. It didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power.
Yes.
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution.
What I'm saying to you this morning, my friend, even if it falls your lot to be a street sweeper. Go on out and sweep streets like Michelangelo painted pictures. Sweep streets like Handel and Beethoven composed music. Sweep streets like Shakespeare wrote poetry. Sweep streets so well that all the hosts of heaven and earth will have to pause and say, here lived a great street sweeper who swept his job well. If you can't be a pine on the top of the hill, be a scrub in the valley, but be the best little scrub on the side of the rill. Be a bush if you can't be a tree. If you can't be a highway, just be a trail. If you can't be the sun.
I want you to get ready for what's going on in this country. We want to talk to you about what happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Black Wall Street. I want to share that with you tonight. We're talking about what happened in 2021, the riot in Chicago. We have come a long way. The murder of many black people all over America. The blood is at the altar. Tonight, I want you to stay focused. Get your pills and paper, write stuff down. I want you to read Psalm 70, Psalm 19, and Psalm 31. We're going to talk about what happened in Greenwood, 11 Tulsa, Oklahoma tonight.
These are people who own their own homes, they have their own businesses.
I've got a special message for you. What I'm not giving you to call me.
May 31st through
I'm going to start giving messages
was 18 hours of
every
sheer terror.
Evening for something going on with some news. So when you call them, I'm going to give you the message that you need.
We don't know who fired the
and
first
what happened. So we got to deal with the violence of our people and what's going on to our country.
If
blacks have
been
armed in Tulsa, Oklahoma,
they woke up
300
women
got killed.
Morning of June 1st.
And in Chicago, 1919 was a race riot here in Chicago.
You are
and
seeing
all over America
murder.
It's been racism and white supremacy.
Murder.
Now we are being murdered.
That
when
late,
we murder them,
the red
we go to jail. We got the political prisoners in jail right now. And what they in jail for, the white folks that did more than that. Stop the killing, save the baby.
And determination of black people turn, way out of nowhere.
It's going to be a different type of thing. I'm praying for you and you tonight. And every door that closes, open up. I want you to get ready.
We believe very strongly that
black folks deserve truth. For God, what God got to do. I'm praying for you. I want to thank Bright Star up in St. Paul, Minnesota, when I was there last week, this week to get there. And I'm praying for you down in Jackson, Mississippi. Those that in Monroe to call me. You're getting ready to open the door. Those in Detroit, you're playing. Get your pen and paper. Some
good
of you
are
so comfortable. You forgot what happened
today,
to your ancestors.
Ugliest chapters in
you
American history
what happened.
Took place.
And I want to bring you back to what happened to black people. I want to bring you back to where we come from.
Famed educator Booker T. Washington coined the business district the Negro Wall Street.
Where we come from. Because our ancestors are false. Those people had hotels and everything. Well, get
they
your business paper.
They built churches.
And
they
I want
educated,
you to call me.
They were organized.
As I talk to
clubs.
You, I'm praying for you
it
to
was
stand.
A vibrant community. They had their own businesses.
I'm praying for you.
These are mostly small businesses.
I'm praying for you.
Mother Ripley. 35 square block area that abutted downtown Tulsa separated
praying,
by the Frisco Drive.
Mother Francis down in that deal right across New Orleans. It was 104 today.
White
she called me New Orleans. We're going
to
get ready and we're going to break this up with you.
Whites understood that
economic people feel that we are separate. It's designed right now for us to fight each other. It's designed.
It was noticed out on the street. Leave town. They're killing all of the black people.
An entire community was destroyed. Their wealth was taken from them.
It looked as if it was Hiroshima. Atomic bomb had gone off. What few trees were left had no leaves. They were just charred.
And then the story was suppressed until almost now.
The Greenwood District, or what it becomes known as Black Wall Street, these are people who own their own homes, they had their own businesses, it was a vibrant community.
What happened in 1921, on May 31st through June the 1st, was 18 hours of the sheriff.
Well, I'll never want to say anything like that again. Never.
We don't know who fired the first gun, but that begins a bloodbath. African Americans are attacked in their home. They are machine gunned down in the street. They woke up to the sound of bullets hitting their home.
Smoke and flames are everywhere.
They set fire to the curtains so the houses will burn. Airplanes, the morning of June 1st, flying over the city and dropping turpentine bombs. You are seeing them get away with murder. Murder.
It wasn't only that took place during a period known as the Red Summer of 1990.
Hopefully it's all covered up. There are generations of folks who grew up in Tulsa who never heard about it.
There's the immediate aftermath of the race massacre, and there is racism in that period of time.
The same will, ingenuity, and determination of black people to make a way out of no way. The charred remains of their hopes, the embers of their dreams, and yet from that wreckage, they rebuilt.
We believe very strongly that black folks deserve truth, reparation, and repair.
Good evening to you. I'm Neil King. 100 years ago today, one of the ugliest chapters in American history took place. The massacre of as many as 300 black people by their white neighbors and the destruction of the Greenwood section of Tulsa, Oklahoma. Greenwood was a source of pride for blacks back in 1921. Famed educator Booker T. Washington coined the business district the Negro Wall Street, because it was prosperous and rich with many black-owned businesses. Tonight, we will explore what happened that day. What was behind the single worst incident of racial violence in American history? Survivors, descendants, and historians try to explain why it happened and how the city and the country will struggle to move on from this tragedy. So here's the question. What did happen on May 31st, 1921.
The Greenwood District was a segregated residential and economic district because it had to be, because of legal segregation that prevailed, not just in Tulsa, but really all over much of the United States.
They built schools, they built churches, they were educated, they were organized, they had social clubs. It was a vibrant community. They had their own businesses.
They're mostly small businesses, all concentrated in this 35 square block area that had flooded downtown, also separated by the Frisco tracks. But there was tremendous resentment, white resentment, to economic success of Greenwood. Whites understood that economic prosperity would ultimately lead to questions of racial equality, social equality. Racial equality, social equality was a non-starter. Segregation was the rule of the land.
What was life like in Greenwood then? I asked two survivors of the 1921 massacre. Viola Fletcher is 107.
Well, we had friends played outside and visited the neighbors and was happy there with our parents. Just loved being there.
And 106-year-old Leslie Benningfield Randall.
What was it like before the men came in with guns? What, were there stores? Was there movies?
Getting to the United States, they had theater and they had other places of recreation and they had churches. And they came in and threw it all down.
There were approximately 200 businesses in Greenwood for the 1921. and not one of those businesses are left standing. The 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre occurs, triggered, catalyzed by an event between two teenagers. A black teenage boy, Dick Rowland, 19 years old, Shine Streets downtown. A white girl, Sarah Page, 17 years old, who operates an elevator in a downtown building called the Drexel Building. We don't know exactly what actually happens, but upon entering, we think he may have tripped and bumped into the white elevator operator, Sarah Page. She screamed.
The clerk from the nearby store comes to her rescue, and Dick Rowland did what any normal African-American would have done, ran. And he ran to Greenwood. Before the day was over, was arrested and brought to the county jail, which, of course, is on the south side of the tracks, in the midst of the white business district.
The Tulsa Tribune published an article entitled, Mad Negro for Attacking Girl in an Elevator. Newspapers, white newspapers, implies that there needs to be a lynching incident. And so Black World War One veteran comes to the house to protect this young man from being lynched. One of the white men in the crowd attempts to disarm one of the, we believe, black veterans. A shot is fired, it hits the white bystander, and they begin firing black men. In the words of a number of survivors of the massacre, all hell broke loose after that. The violence lasted roughly 16 hours. A black man in the Greenwood area put up a vigorous, albeit short, they were outnumbered, outgunned.
The sheriff has detained a number of white citizens who have no training in law enforcement, mob control. They have now been given legal permission to participate in mayhem, looting and murdering.
Some of the people in the Greenwood community had fine things like pianos and china and so forth.
Stone brick in people's houses. It's destructive. That's all I saw, this destruction.
And it was given notice, so out on the street, leave town, they're killing all the black people.
My mother looked out the front door, and she saw four men with torches walking from the street sidewalk to our house. And all of a sudden, she says, all of you, get up under the bed, quick, quick. And all of us scrambled. They came in and fired through the curtain, and one stepped on my fingers, and my sister put her hand over my mouth to be sure to stop me, because she fell. I was fixing my collar because it hurt.
People are shooting guns and killing people and all. If we don't leave, they'll do us that way.
Many eyewitnesses report that planes dropped what I'll call incendiary devices on the community. So these would have been nitroglycerin or kerosene bombs that caused the flames to spread more rapidly and burn more brilliantly. So this had a devastating impact on the community.
Men came in and started shooting. And I do remember a lot of people being murdered.
These people escaped their homes. Some are shot down in the street, and others are gathered by the white mob and marched, in my grandfather's case, to the convention hall. They were stripped of their civil rights. Black men, women, and children were forced to leave their homes, and they are forced, with their hands raised, to walk, to be paraded through the streets, taken to internment centers throughout the city. Very much like people of Japanese ancestry were interned during World War II. I would say it's not just a massacre. This is systematic. What occurred is a military-style assault on a civilian community.
Do you think about that day a lot, or do you try never to think about it?
Oh, no, I think about it every day. Yeah, it'll be something I'll never forget. The people getting killed, had to give up our home and all.
I want the world to know I never want to see anything else like that anymore. And I hope it never happens again.
The destruction of Greenwood left behind rubble and ashes in its wake, but it also caused harm to generations of descendants who lost more than their ancestors and material wealth. They lost a legacy of success that is hard to imagine or quantify.
My earliest memory of hearing about the Dreamland Theater was in high school when my mother mentioned it to me. And it wasn't like she talked in depth about what happened. It was our family owned the Dreamland Theater. They were the first Black Tulsans to have a car, but how they lost everything was never really discussed. I'm Danya Backus, the CBS News correspondent and descendant of Black Wall Street. My great-great-grandparents, John and Luba Williams, owned the Dreamland Theater, the Williams Confectionery, and an auto garage. John and Luba Williams were the picture of the American dream. The Dreamland Theater was a 750-seat theater, and it did not just show silent movies, but apparently it had acts, they had boxing matches. My great-great-grandmother, Lula, actually had two other locations. So the Dreamland Theater was this entertainment hub for Tulsa, but it also was, I think, the beginning of an empire.
My name is John Rogers, Jr. I'm the co-CEO of Ariel Investments. My ties to Tulsa start with the fact that my great-grandfather, J.B. Stratford, owned the Stratford Hotel that was burned down during the famous Tulsa Race Massacre 100 years ago. J.B. Stratford was an extraordinary entrepreneur, someone who had this knack of building businesses and creating enormous wealth. The Stratford Hotel at its peak was the largest African-American-owned hotel in the United States. Not only did it have this 54-room hotel that was very large for its time, but it had a pool hall, a cabaret, it had restaurants.
I'm Danya Backus in Tulsa, Oklahoma, uncovering the history of Black Wall Street.
To know that I am a part of this history and I'm able to tell the story, it has taken on a new meaning and responsibility for me.
This is where the Dreamland Theater was.
Yes, right here.
And now it's a freeway.
Even now as I talk to elders of the family about what happened, even cousins who grew up in Tulsa, many of them are now just starting to put together all of the pieces. This is the pillar that saves promise to our family,
the W.D. Williams.
And we ask, why wasn't it talked about? Many of them don't know.
And David Williams here.
The assumption is that it was just too painful to relive those memories. My great-grandfather, he did talk about it in the community, and he was one of the first survivors to be interviewed.
I woke up the next morning, all this shooting started over.
Did you ever get shot at when you ran across the street?
Oh, yeah, you could hear bullets singing down the street.
Ooh. Okay.
Hearing that firsthand, it hit me in a way that reading about it is one thing, but I think when you actually hear it, and you hear it from someone who you know is a part of your family, it impacts you differently.
My great-grandfather talks about in his memoir what really happened that day. He said, I was sitting in the window of the lobby looking westward. I saw an airplane approaching the hotel from the west. It came sailing like a huge bird in the direction of the hotel about 200 feet above the ground. And just before it reached the hotel, it swerved a little and fired through the transoms and plate windows. J.B. Stratford not only lost all of the property that he owned and the Stratford Hotel, but I think most importantly, psychologically, and I understand this as an entrepreneur, he put his heart and soul into that hotel. And to see it destroyed overnight was just gut-wrenching.
And when he came to Chicago afterwards, he had these dreams of trying to recreate a success that he'd had in Tulsa. And to be able to build a new hotel and build new pool halls and have things that are successful. And he never was able to remotely achieve the success that he had in Tulsa.
W.D. Williams, my great-grandfather, talks about sleeping in a tent for about 6 months until they actually started rebuilding. The Dreamland Theater was rebuilt. The Williams building where the confectionery and where they lived, that was rebuilt. In order for them to be able to rebuild the Dreamland Theater on Black Wall Street, they had to sell the other two theaters. So they were able to rebuild, but it was never what it was pre-massacre. Hatred and jealousy wiped away our family's chance of generational wealth. I could have been an heir to an empire, and that was all wiped away.
I'm in the investment business and understand the magic of compound interest. That $125,000 hotel and the property that J.B. Stratford had in 1921, 100 years later, it would be worth well over $100 million. Broadly speaking, it would have been transformative for opportunities in our family. There's very little multi-generational wealth in the African-American community. We haven't had that chance to be able to leave inheritances and have family members living off of the dividends of the work that their ancestors accomplished.
It makes me angry to know that so many people went out of their way to make sure that this history was not learned about. It makes me angry to know that my ancestors had to hold on to that trauma for so long as well. I do think we need to be talking about it more. I also do think that it's really scary to know and to feel like there are still some fears that I know they experienced that I still experience today, to know that that hatred and jealousy still lives in some people.
This idea that you could have this extraordinary success story where African Americans were fully participating in our capitalist democracy. No one at the time dreamed it could just all go away overnight. That it could be firebombed and destroyed. You know, there's so many challenges that continue to face our community. We have to remember this history and inspire all of us to fight even harder for economic and social justice.
The Tulsa Massacre did not happen in a vacuum. Between 1917 and 1923, thousands of black people were killed, their homes and businesses destroyed, and as many as 26 race massacres across the country. In 1919, civil rights activist and writer James Weldon Johnson called it the Red Summer. That term came to represent an era of violence and bloodshed.
The Red Summer of 1919 was coined that because of the lynchings, because of the death of so many black people.
In the years just prior to the Red Summer, there was almost 500,000 African-Americans in the first wave of the Great Migration.
We saw black people fanning out from Mississippi up to Chicago and along the Delta, from Georgia and Alabama up to Detroit, from North Carolina up to New York, from Louisiana over to Los Angeles, and there was tremendous tension.
Massacres during the Red Summer weren't necessarily isolated to one part of the country. They really occurred in the South, New England, the Midwest, the Plain States, the Pacific Northwest. Racial violence can be seen in nearly every state in the Union.
Remember, 1915 or thereabouts, with Birth of a Nation, a cinematic portrayal of black men, the unrequited desire to rape white women, to give to themselves sexually. As a result of that, there's a buzz in the atmosphere. The Ku Klux Klan is on the rise.
You have the President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, screening the film in the White House. This is the messaging that was coming from the White House.
19 months of war, we have sent 2 million men overseas and have suffered 350,000 casualties.
If black people support it,
the American war effort. Perhaps that would create white goodwill. Perhaps black people would experience an elevation and status in America.
Black men went off to World War I. They saw what could be. They understood the significance of democracy.
We see these black veterans returning to America expecting the same kind of freedom because they've been in defense of American democracy.
But what we saw was the opposite. Instead of white goodwill, we saw white lynch mobs and white mobs attacking black communities.
And one of the tensions was that you got a lot more black people in place when you came back than when you left. And what's that? Oh, they took my job? Oh, what's that? They're occupying space in the culture that used to be occupied by me financially and economically, in mills and in shops.
There was a great majority of white citizens who saw black people as, who are you to have that house, to have that college degree, to build that school, to not clean my house? Who are you to wear some of the finest clothes? It was more of, you're not supposed to have, but I am.
So whether it was these soldiers returning home, if it was African Americans that had attained some level of power, or that perhaps dated white women, any incidents that whites, and especially poor whites, considered to be kind of a threat to their territory, was often a spurring factor.
One of the deadliest, quote-unquote, race riots in Chicago.
In Chicago in 1919 was African-American boy named Eugene Williams who had floated from what was considered black water into white water.
Eugene was swimming. He inadvertently crossed 29 feet, you know, barrier that separated black and white communities, swimming.
And the white beachgoers ended up stoning him to death, and he was really just a child.
Because of the stoning to death set off several days of conflagration between white and black.
They were just yelling at us. All of a sudden, I heard my uncle say, "Here they come." And when he said that, it meant that the white folks were coming down 35th Street.
And 23 black people dead, 13 white people dead. Black people are not taking it lying down. Returning soldiers and veterans would grab their guns and rifles to defend themselves and to not be victims of violence in this country.
Even somewhere north and somewhere kind of considered progressive like Chicago still had these kind of invisible lines of where black people were allowed to be and not allowed to be. Elaine, Arkansas, it's a unique case. It's likely that over 200 people died in what's known as the Elaine Massacre. Many of the sharecroppers in the region were historically not given enough pay for their cotton when it came time to sell, and so they formed their own union, which was seen as an uprising by the local white landowners. So it became kind of a manhunt throughout the town and throughout the countryside. These are hardworking families that were being gunned down in the street for wanting to organize their labor and receive more equitable pay.
Black people became target practice. Women, children, men, until the military came in and brought it to a halt. There was a hearing afterward of African-American men accused of starting this event. And it took the NAACP to come in and to fight for them so that they ultimately were given their freedom.
You can drive through Rosewood, Florida in about 15 seconds with no clue about the ugly American story that happened.
In Rosewood, Florida, 1923, a man was accused of attempting to rape a white woman. The result was that a group of white citizens went to confront this man at his home. The threat of violence and death, and ultimately they destroyed the entire black community.
You can hear them shooting. You can hear them people screaming, hollering. You can see fire burning, the light from the fire from a distance. You know that what they were doing. They were burning up people's homes and killing them.
There was a thriving black community in this area, and they killed several people, and many of the people had to leave their homes and run to the railroad tracks. And ultimately, many of the people who were killed were buried in a mass grave.
But I still can't figure out yet the reason for them to burn our home. Because my mother was there with six kids.
A lot of the information that we're learning about these incidents are from oral histories of people that were there. We thought maybe 24 events during the Red Summer. We now know of almost 48.
What happens during Red Summer of 1919, none of that should be a surprise, even where we are today, because the issue of race is still a lingering issue in this nation.
How did Tulsa deal with the aftermath of the killing and destruction on May 31st and June 1st? Black and white Tulsans did not talk about the massacre for different reasons, but off and on, there was a rebuilding.
I would describe the rebuilding of Greenwood immediately after the race massacre as one of the great heroic stories in American history. Can you imagine having your business and your home destroyed and the people who do it are never prosecuted, never held accountable?
There wasn't much left but smoldering embers. Fortunately, though, the human spirit reigned supreme.
For the same men who just lost their own loved ones, lost their own businesses, those individuals came back to worship and they restored our basement. And our basement was a central hub until the rest of Greenwood was developed.
Immediately after the massacre, there was an effort by the city to extend the fire code, which would have made it cost prohibitive for many people to rebuild in the community. Fortunately, we had a lawyer in the community called B.C. Franklin. B.C. Franklin challenged those efforts to extend the fire code successfully. He represented a number of massacre victims with their legal claims as well. So the community fought on every front to rebound and to rebuild.
Federal troops were sent to Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1921 to put down race riots that had ended in the destruction of the Negro section of the city.
The city labeled what happened a riot instead of what it was, which was a massacre.
This was not just some casual journalistic term that was tossed around. It was done explicitly to keep us from getting the needed funds to rebuild.
Those insurance companies did not pay out on those policies due to the fact that the event was classified as a riot versus being a massacre. Many of the families who had businesses outside of Tulsa, like the Dreamland Theater, they had locations outside of Tulsa as well, they were able to have money, income to come in. However, all of the businesses in Greenwood who had insurance, they did not get paid out due to these events.
We now have minutes from the Chamber of Commerce from that era, from the City Commission. And what you see in the days immediately after it happened was widespread recognition by city leaders throughout the community that this was a major source of shame and embarrassment for our city. And the best way for Tulsa to be able to move forward was just not to talk about it at all. To act like it never happened.
I used to be a reporter for the CBS affiliate here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I remember going, how come nobody's talking about this? This used to be the Wes Archer lunchroom right here. It's the only remembrance, but if you look up what used to be the lunchroom, is now the minor league ballpark.
When we say the Greenwood community, we have to be very clear that what existed at the time of the massacre was 40 blocks. Now that's down to half a block.
Well, I think there are two phases in the history of Greenwood that you have to focus on. There's the immediate aftermath of the race massacre, and there is rebuilding in that period of time. But then you have urban renewal hit Tulsa in the 60s and the 70s, and that's the time when you see entire neighborhoods bulldozed, which are still vacant land today. That's when you see a highway built right through the middle of Greenwood that's still there today.
As a reporter, you notice it. Why are the folks who live in North Tulsa not as affluent as the folks who live in South Tulsa?
And what we see happening in much of Greenwood south of the highway is not black owned. We see a lot of development, a lot of what they call gentrification. I like to call it what it is, lands there.
A lot of land was stolen from us. Then you burn us down and we rebuild accordingly. And then you come and tear us back down. I mean, current day, our whole goal is to protect and preserve what we currently have.
In order for the city to receive their upgrades,
when I came to the Greenwood District, there really wasn't much going on, not nearly as much that's going on now. There's new buildings going up. I just don't know how much of the black community has any influence on what goes up.
They're building
white-owned businesses that are going to benefit white Tulsa and not the black community, which has been pushed further out north into a community that has not received any investment for decades.
I actually own and operate Rose Tax Solutions, and we're a full-service boutique firm located right on Greenwood Avenue across the street from my dad. He has a bail bonds company, and two doors down from my nieces who operate a restaurant, Wanda J's, and across the street from a coffee shop where my cousin is a co-owner.
We have 26 exact-owned businesses in Pendleton. So to go from 600 in 1921, 26, it's nowhere near what we had.
For black businesses and leaders not to be in place in order to actually get contracts accepted to build and construct again, you take away a lot from a group of individuals who cannot build and don't have that same opportunity. That's our goal, is to own. We don't want to keep renting.
How weird would it be if they build this up and everybody comes to see Black Wall Street, but it doesn't have that feel of Black Wall Street? I would hope that the black community that's here in Tulsa would have a say in the rebuilding of what was theirs that they originally built up.
I go to the City Hall every Wednesday since September 2018.
And thanks for the deal.
Every Wednesday. But let the world know, we demand reparations now.
Different people define reparations in different ways. There's the more traditional idea of cash payments to people. The challenge with that for me is where that cash comes from. So I don't support that. But then there's a different definition of reparations, which is acknowledging the disparities that do exist and working to reconcile those and address the underlying causes of those disparities.
We're not seeking a specific number in the law. We're just simply asking that the court give us the opportunity to bring in the experts, to tell the court and the world what would it take to put the community back where it would have been but for the massacre and the continuing harm.
To have it look like it did back before they destroyed it, before they put this interstate highway through the heart of our Greenwood community. That's what it looks like to me. A self-contained place of black entrepreneurial excellence.
Man, a true rebuild would be where we own the land, we're able to build, you know, we're circling the dollar, it's inclusive, we're just booming again, and we're thriving, we have like that strong community. That would be amazing for Tulsa.
In 2019, Oklahoma passed a law requiring the Tulsa Race Massacre to be taught in schools. That is a huge step forward for Tulsans, both black and white, who grew up never knowing what happened nearly 100 years before. One thing is clear, though. It's important, very important, to dig up the past in order to realize a better future. Greenwood is hopeful. We're hopeful to build something that actually sustains throughout the generation to come.
Building Greenwood Rising, the sister center that's going to open to tell the story in an immersive way and to connect the dots so that people understand that our history is really not simply something that's in the past. It's part of our present.
In order for our children to know what happened here, what their ancestors did or suffered from, it has to be taught.
Well, I'm so thankful that the state is including this in their curriculum. It's important to understand our past and to understand what happened and to have people be able to learn the lessons from that event. But then moving forward, I also think it's so important that this be taught in schools, because what happened here in 1921 could absolutely happen again today.
So we have to dig deep and understand our history, and that's what the future has to be about, knowing it, acknowledging it, and learning each other's history. That's why the excavations of the graves is so important. It is vitally important for the healing of
our community that those bodies be laid to rest in peace, not having been dumped in a mass grave by some stranger that didn't know who they were.
Mayor Bynum decided to restart the investigation for mass graves. He should have. If there are mass graves, we need to know about that. We need to answer these historical questions.
I think it's one of the most fundamental things that any American city promises its citizens is, if you're murdered in our city, we will do everything we can to find out what happened to you and to render justice for your family.
It requires, ultimately, identification of the remains and connections with heirs of people who are victims. And finally, it requires reinterment appropriately of those remains. So this is a complex, tedious process, but it's worth the effort.
You know, we can't go back in time and prevent the race massacre from having happened in 1921, but we can be a better city in 2021 by trying to find these graves, hoping to be able to use DNA evidence to ultimately connect them with the descendants, and finally, a century too late, be able to tell the descendants of these victims where their remains are and let them decide what.
T-Mobile 5G home internet is here. With a 15-minute setup.
Thank you very kindly, my friend. As I listen to Ralph Abernathy and his eloquent and generous introduction, and then about myself, I wondered who he was talking about. It's always good to have your closest friend and associate to say something good about you. And Ralph Abernathy is the best friend that I have in the world. I'm delighted to see each of you here tonight in spite of a storm warning. You reveal that you are determined to go on anyhow. Something is happening, and then something is happening in our world. And you know, if I was standing at the beginning of time with the possibility of taking a kind of general and panoramic view of the whole of human history up to now, and the Almighty said to me, Martin Luther King, which age do you like to live in? I would take my mental flight by Egypt. And I would watch God's children in their magnificent trek from the dark dungeons of Egypt through, or rather across the Red Sea, through the wilderness on toward the Promised Land. And in spite of its magnificence, I wouldn't stop there. I would move on by Greece and take my mind to Mount Olympus. And I would see Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, Euripides, and Aristophanes, the symbol around the Parthenon. I would watch them around the Parthenon as they discuss the great and eternal issues of reality, but I wouldn't stop there. I would go on even to the great heyday of the Roman Empire. And I would see developments around there through various emperors and leaders, but I wouldn't stop there. I would even come up to the day of the Renaissance and get a quick picture of all that the Renaissance did for the cultural and aesthetic life of man, but I wouldn't stop there. I would even go by the way that the man for whom I'm named had his habitat. And I would watch Martin Luther as he tacks his 95 theses on the door at the Church of Wittenberg, but I wouldn't stop there. I would come on up even to 1863 and watch a vacillating president by the name of Abraham Lincoln finally come to the conclusion that he had to sign the Emancipation Proclamation, but I wouldn't stop there. I would even come up to the early 30s and see a man grappling with the problems of the bankruptcy of his nation, come with an eloquent cry that we have nothing to fear but fear itself, but I wouldn't stop there. Strangely enough, I would turn to the Almighty and say, if you allow me to live just a few years in the second half of the 20th century, I will be happy. Now, that's a strange statement to make because the world is all messed up. The nation is sick. Trouble is in the land. Confusion all around. That's a strange statement. But I know somehow that only when it is dark enough can you see the star. And I see God working in this period of the 20th century in a way that men in some strange way are responding. Something is happening in our world. The masses of people are rising up, and wherever they are assembled today, whether they are in Johannesburg, South Africa, Nairobi, Kenya, Accra, Ghana, New York City, Atlanta, Georgia, Jackson, Mississippi, or Memphis, Tennessee, the cry is always the same. We want to be free. Another reason that I'm happy to live in this period is that we have been forced to a point where we are going to have to grapple with the problems that men have been trying to grapple with through history, but the demands didn't force them to do it. Survival demands that we grapple with them. Men for years now have been talking about war and peace, but now no longer can they just talk about it. It is no longer the choice between violence and nonviolence in this world. It's nonviolence or non-existence. That is where we are today. Also in the human rights revolution, if something isn't done and done in a hurry to bring the colored people of the world out of their long years of poverty, their long years of hurt and neglect, the whole world is doomed. Now, I'm just happy that God has allowed me to live in this period. see what is unfolding. And I'm happy that he's allowed me to be in Memphis. I can remember when Negroes were just going around, as Ralph has said, so often scratching where they didn't itch and laughing when they were not tickled. But that day is all over. We mean business now, and we are determined to gain our rightful place in God's world. And that's all this whole thing is about. We aren't engaged in any negative protest and in any negative arguments with anybody. We are saying that we are determined to be men. We are determined to be people. We are saying, that we are God's children. And if we are God's children, we don't have to live like we are forced to live. Now, what does all of this mean in this great period of history? It means we've got to stay together. We've got to stay together and maintain unity. You know, whenever Pharaoh wanted to prolong the period of slavery in Egypt, he had a favorite formula for doing it. What was that? He kept the slaves fighting among themselves. But whenever the slaves get together, something happens in Pharaoh's court, and he cannot hold the slaves in slavery. When the slaves get together, that's the beginning of getting out of slavery. Now let us maintain unity. Secondly, let us keep the issues where they are. The issue is injustice. The issue is the refusal of Memphis to be fair and honest in its dealings with its public servant, who happened to be sanitation workers. Now, we've got to keep attention on. That's always the problem with a little violence. You know what happened the other day, and the press dealt only with the window breaker. I read the article. They very seldom got around to mentioning the fact that 1,300 sanitation workers are on strike and that Memphis is not being fed and that Mayor Loeb is in dire need of a doctor. They didn't get around to that. Now we're going to march again, and we've got to march again in order to put the issue where it is supposed to be. I want everybody to see the bow of 1,300 of God's children here. Sometimes wondering how this thing is going to come out. That's the issue. We've got to say to the nation, we know how it's coming out. But when people get